Okay, let's talk about point number 9. Let's talk about compatibility, because I asked Bill and Helen if there were some questions or topics that people felt they'd like to be addressed. And one of the topics that a number of you spoke to was the area of compatibility. So I want to talk about that for a few minutes, if we can do that today, okay? Let's talk about compatibility. So I want to start with a little story. It's in your book. When it comes to compatibility, my wife and I didn't write this. This isn't my wife and I, somebody else. When it comes to compatibility, my wife and I could not be more different. While driving around town when my oldest son was 3, a traffic light prompted him to ask me what a yellow light meant. "Son," I began with my best wise fatherly voice, "a yellow light means proceed with caution." His inquisitive mind wanted to test out his theory, so he asked the same question of my wife the next day. "Son," she informed him while weaving her hands in emphasis, "a yellow light means step on the gas." My wife has places to go quickly, but I like to take my time and enjoy the scenery. We are different from each other. We are so very different from each other. And in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, God says, "And they shall become one flesh." I pray that you can burn that phrase into your brain. Shall become. You haven't arrived. You're not there yet. You're growing. You're learning. Keep going. You shall become. You are shall becoming. Okay? We need to see compatibility not as a noun, but as a verb. We need to see it as a verb, not a noun. We often see it as a noun when it really is a verb. It speaks of action. It speaks of action, not a thing, but an action. And here's a good definition for you of compatibility in your marriage. Compatibility is the process of learning how to turn your differences into assets and not liabilities. It's the process of learning how to process your differences, to turn them into assets, not liabilities. When we got married, we decide, that's being everybody who gets married, that's the day you begin to learn to be compatible. That's when you really, really learn to be compatible. Before that, you're always dating, you're on your best behavior, you look nice, you smell nice, and all that stuff, you go to nice places. But when you get married, you know what? It's kind of like behind closed doors, and you're seen in your jammies for what you really are. And, you know, it's not necessarily the prettiest thing on the planet for both of you. And let me give an example. When I was going to school, training for ministry, I would always get up. It would be dark. And so I like to be a little organized and disciplined and so on. My wife says I got OCD, but she doesn't know. So I would organize my closet so that on the right-hand side are the black pants, and the next ones beside them are the gray pants. And over here are my shirts, and my shirts always face that way. And I only button the top button, not all the buttons, so that I have quick access. I flip the button on the shirt, I take it off, I put it on, I get up, I'm out the door before I really alarm my roommate. And in my sock drawer, the black socks are over here and the gray socks are over here. And I got everything organized and it is just running smooth. And then I got married. And my wife is the most giving person on the planet. And she really wanted to bless me and impress me. So she did the laundry. And the next morning I went to open up the closet to get my clothes. There was a shirt in the middle of the pants. We got a problem. And that shirt is buttoned all the way down the front so it won't wrinkle. this is really cutting into my style. And she thinks she's done such a wonderful thing. And she did. And I thought, my next thought, well, what's the sock drawer going to look like? I don't even want to go look. And I went and looked, and oh, my goodness. The brown ones were with the black ones, and they were all mixed up. And you know what? We learned that we're different from each other. And you know what? You're not going to fight over, I'm going to get into conflict a little bit later. I'm going to get in conflict for saying some of the things I'm saying. I forgot what I was going to say. Here it is. We don't fight over the big stuff. What God we're going to serve, what church we're going to go, what city we're going to live. We don't fight over the big stuff. We fight over the little stuff. Why did you leave that lay there? I like to be neat and tidy. Well, somebody likes to make the bed, somebody doesn't. You know, we're different. Why do you leave? We're different from each other. And so when you get married, I don't care who you are, you're going to have to learn to turn your assets into your differences into assets, not liabilities. You have to learn that. And, you know, it's going to rub across things that really aren't that important, but you think they are important. Important to you, but not the other person. So it's a process. It's a process. And you know what? None of us were born compatible. We all were born incompatible, every one of us. We've all been born with a very sinful and selfish nature. Every one of us. We've been born that way. And Webster defines compatibility this way: as the capability to live together in harmony. The capability to live together in harmony. Our culture highly values compatibility in marriage, but the common belief is that you must meet the right person in order to attain this. If you find the right person, then harmony will naturally ensue. It'll happen. No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. The Bible, however, teaches that harmonious marriages are anything but natural. Since the fall in Genesis 3, sin makes us incompatible as relationships become naturally strained and fractured. But the gospel gives us hope to live in accord with others as Jesus reconstructs relationships. We become other-focused instead of self-focused. That's the shift that needs to happen if you're going to have harmony and happiness in your home. The moment you become selfish, that's when you're stepping on landmines. That's when the joy starts to leak out of the bottom of the bucket of your love and relationship. When you're other-focused, everybody wins. Romans 15:5 says this: may the God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Jesus Christ. May he grant you endurance and encouragement. May he grant you to live in such harmony with each other. Endurance, encouragement, harmony. So let me read a couple other things here for you. While it is true that you need someone different to complement you, research findings are highly consistent that the most stable marriages are those involving two people with many similarities. That's pretty basically true. Okay? We need to mitigate that with another significant factor. The more different two people are, if they are determined to live in a strong, happy, covenant marriage, they're going to have to struggle all the more to create such a happy and a healthy and wonderful marriage. You just got to work harder, that's all. You can get there. Hey, remember, this is a treasure hunt. This is a mystery. You're different. And you know, sometimes you think the grass is greener on the other side of the street. Well, if I was married to so-and-so, it wouldn't be. You don't know that. You don't know that. But you know what happens when you really have to struggle together? You become stronger. You become way stronger. And the point being this: the more you invest in something, the more you strive together for survival. The more you struggle for something, the more valuable it becomes. If it's easy come, then it's easy go. But when you've invested your heart and your soul in this, You've given it everything you've got. You don't want to just walk away and give it up. You don't want to do that because you put so much into it. It's of value to you. The deeper and the more meaningful your relationship will be. It seems that these marriages become the most meaningful. Bill and Helen, are you still in here? Bill, would you come up here? I told you I was going to ask you to do this. Bill and Helen, would you both come up here for a second? We need that other microphone, Pastor Josh. Can we borrow that for a minute? Bill and Helen didn't want to do this, but they have to. What do I do to turn this on? It's on? Okay, I got red light. That's good?
That's good.
Okay. We had, Linda and I had dinner a couple times with Bill and Helen as we talked about this weekend, and we just started sharing some stories because we were talking about how tough it is when you start out. And so I'm going to share a story that Linda and I have, but I asked Bill and Helen to share a story about what it was like for them when they got started. So it's not a long story, but it's a very meaningful story, and I insist that they share this with you. So please, go ahead. Thank you for being vulnerable.
Actually, I'm going to defer to my wife because she explains this story much better than I do.
I don't know if it's a story or a few stories, but when we first got married, we were pulling decent salaries. We were both management at TELUS, and things were going really well. And then God blessed us with our first child, and we had determined that we were going to have me stay home. And a lot of people came up and said to us, "Oh, you're doing the right thing. It's hard on one's salary, but God will bless you." And we thought, "Oh, yeah, right." You know, people always say things like that. And I can't lie. It was challenging, and it was difficult on one's salary. And, we had, to look after all the expenses and everything. But God used people in our lives. And his mom, she would come and say, "Oh, toilet paper is on sale. I bought you guys some. Dishwashing liquid is on sale." Sometimes we would be on our last, container of dishwashing liquid. And, how did she know we needed it? How did our parents know that they dropped by with a soya chicken? Different things like that. And so, it was a struggle. And yet, we didn't regret it. And I think even of the times when we decided to renovate our home and we wanted to do it ourselves. And so after we put the kids to bed, we would run outside and start carrying in pieces of gyprock, and it's really heavy. But you know what? We laughed. We struggled together. And I think a lot of people said, "Oh, it's going to wreck your marriage, trying to renovate." But you know what? It made us stronger. And the struggle that we went through just really cemented that relationship for us.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's exactly what I wanted you to share. Thank you very much. See, when you struggle together, you really become tighter with each other. And I don't mean this the wrong way, but when you come into marriage with everything, there's nothing that causes you to struggle together. There's nothing that causes you to struggle and bind you together. When Linda and I were married, we'd been married a few years, and then I was still in my 20s when I went to pastor my first church. And we were sent to a little church in a place called Invermere, B.C., Fairmont Hot Springs. Beautiful, beautiful place. Beautiful place. Really tiny little church, my very first church. I went into my office the first day as a pastor, and I sat down and I said, "I have no idea what to do here." I had no idea what to do. And here we were. We're thousands of miles away from her family, 1,000 miles away from my family, all by ourselves in this wee little town. And we looked at each other and go, "You know what? We've got each other, and that's it. We've just got each other. We need each other really, really bad." And we started to grow together. And my first salary was $400 a month. That was my salary. And it was hard. It was really, really hard. And the only way that we could make it is if we had a huge, huge garden. And so we had this massive garden that was as big as these two sections right here. And we were counting on this food to get us through the year. And I don't know if you know this or not, so I planted this massive garden. We did. And I don't know if you know this, but in June, I think all the mosquitoes of the universe converge in Invermere. And I had to go out there and work the garden with all these mosquitoes. And I hate mosquitoes. And she wouldn't come out because there's mosquitoes out there. Okay? So I'm out there by myself. And we actually have a picture of me out there where I've got on these long pants and I've got my pants tucked into my socks so the mosquitoes can't bite my ankles. And I've got on this great big heavy leather jacket in 90 degree weather with long sleeves, and I'm wearing gloves, and I got it taped up so mosquitoes can't. I got the hat on, I got the bandana, and there's just this much skin showing, and that's all bitten by mosquitoes. And I'm out there working this garden for the hours. Because without this, we're not going to make it. You know, that striving together really made us closer to each other, made us much closer to each other. And you know what? You learn to be compatible. When you're in survival mode, you learn real quick what's really worth fighting for and what isn't. We had our first child at Invermere, and he developed a sort of lactose intolerance. I don't think the word was invented back then. And he couldn't have regular, he had to have a special diet. And we didn't have the money for it. We just didn't have it. How are we going to do this? Because we didn't anticipate this. And I'll never forget as long as I live that it's Friday afternoon and I don't get paid until Sunday at the end of the day. And then Monday morning, we go buy the food for our baby. It was Friday afternoon, and we didn't have enough for Saturday or Sunday. What are we going to do? We're not going to go ask anybody. We're not going to do that. We panicked. We're young. God, like, how do we do this? And then the phone rang. The phone rang. And it was the man who was the pastor of my home church, but I'd never met him because I was at school while he was pastoring. So I'd never met him, but I knew who he was, and he heard my name. And he said, "We're passing through Invermere. We're just passing through. It's noon." And I'm going, "Oh, man, we can't even provide lunch for them. Lord, please, because we don't have it." And he said, "We want to stop by your house. We're going to get out of the house. We're going to stand and talk with you in the driveway for no more than 10 minutes. We're not going in your house. We just want to come say hello and pray with you and leave." Whew. So they showed up. We talked and visited for a while. We prayed. They're going to get in the car. He says, "Oh, yeah, by the way." And he shakes my hand and he puts something in my hand and he drives away and I open my hand. It's $20. Do you want to guess how much money we needed? $20. $20. We went right to the store and bought the stuff for our little boy. When you struggle together, you grow together. And compatibility becomes a desire. It's not something that you want to fight against, but you fight for. And those experiences like Bill and Helen, as I listened to Bill and Helen share that story and a couple of others, you could just hear it in their voices and see it on their faces that's really where they've set some deep roots in their relationship. And you know, compatibility became pretty good. Instead of fighting against each other, we're fighting for with each other. And so the struggles, they may be hard sometimes. But if you let God use them, he will design them to make your relationship deeper and stronger than you ever could have imagined. Billy Graham and Ruth Graham married on June 1943, Friday the 13th. Okay? Friday the 13th. Years later, Ruth described their relationship as happily incompatible. I like that. Happily incompatible. She said, "We don't have a perfect marriage, but we have a great one. Being human, Not one of us will ever have a relationship with another person that does not have a wrinkle or a wart or something on it. It just will. She was being interviewed by Larry King once, and so he's really pressing her. Now, come on, Mrs. Graham, come on. Don't tell me that you have never thought about divorce. No, come on. In your deepest secrets in your heart, there has to have been a time in your life where you thought, you know what, maybe we should get a divorce. I love her answer. She said, divorce, no, murder, yes. There's times I could just kill him. And you know, if she could kill Billy Graham, then maybe there's hope for me too, okay? Okay, let me show you how men and women are different from each other. I'm going to give you something from a woman's diary and from a man's diary. It's in your book. I wanted to put it there. But before we read it, I want to tell you this. The reason we put so much emphasis into this booklet is not just for this weekend, but for future reference. Okay? So that you can go back into it when that person you're married to is making you so mad you don't know what to do with them. You can go back and read something here that'll help you get back on point, okay? But we're different from each other. And I read this a little while ago, and I love this story. So here's the wife's diary. Tonight, I thought my husband was acting weird. We'd made plans to meet at a nice restaurant for dinner. I was shopping with my friends all day long, so I thought he was upset at the fact that I was a bit late. But he made no comment on it. Conversation wasn't flowing. So I suggested that we go somewhere quiet so we could talk. He agreed, but he didn't say much. This is her diary. I asked him what was wrong. He said, nothing. Typical, right? I asked him if it was my fault that he was upset. He said he wasn't upset, that it had nothing to do with me and not to worry about it. Oh, say that to your wife, right? On the way home, I told him that I loved him. He smiled slightly and he kept driving. I can't explain his behavior. I don't know why he didn't say, I love you too. When we got home, I felt as if I had lost him completely, as if he wanted nothing to do with me anymore. He just sat there quietly and he watched TV. He continued to seem distant and absent. Finally, with silence all around us, I decided to go to bed. About 15 minutes later, he came to bed. But I still felt like he was distracted and his thoughts were somewhere else. He fell asleep. I cried. I didn't know what to do. I'm almost sure that his thoughts were with someone else. My life is a disaster. And in his diary, it says, a 2-foot putt. How does a guy miss a 2-foot putt? We laugh at that because we get it, right? We get it. How does a guy miss a 2-foot putt? Women love details. They do. They love details. You come home, and she'll say, so what do you do today? You know what? I've already used my 10,000 words. I don't want to talk anymore today. And she wants to know every detail of my day. And she's eager to tell me all about her day. She's so relational. Or she can talk on the phone for 20, 30 minutes, and I used to say, what did you talk about? I don't ask that anymore because I don't have that much time. And she wants to tell me what they talked about. Or someone will phone me and we'll be on the phone for maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes max, 10 minutes. And she said, what did you guys talk about? Oh, nothing. And that annoys her. She wants to know. She wants to share. We are different from each other. And we've got to learn how to make that work. So I've got a little assignment for you. We're going to take maybe 10, 15 minutes, maybe 10 minutes here. What I want you to do is I want you to be alone where you are. You are not allowed to look at the person beside you. Incidentally, I forgot to tell you the rules of engagement for the seminar today. As we go through things, rule number one, you are not allowed to elbow the person beside you. You are not allowed to give them the look. You are not allowed to make guttural sounds as like, yeah, right. That's you. You are not allowed to do these things, okay? Those are the rules of engagement. So what I would like you to do right where you are, you've got the page in front of you. I would like you to write down some of the ways that you and your spouse are different from each other. If you're the husband, talk about yourself. If it's your wife, talk about her, and vice versa, okay? So I would like you to take you talk about ways in which you are different from each other. And then I want you to write down some of the ways that you are similar to each other. So I'm going to give you maybe 5, 7, 8, 10 minutes to do that, okay? So take a few minutes to write down ways that you are similar to each other and ways that you are different to each other, okay? Go. Elbows tucked in. No looking, no peeking. And if you're single and you're not married and you're thinking about it, describe yourself. Describe yourself. And then what Prince Charming would be like. Okay, go. We're talking about compatibility. And to be compatible, we've got to learn to identify our differences and to embrace them and figure out how to make them work. You know, the word we're striving is derived from unity in diversity. Unity in diversity. I learned this from Ravi Zacharias. You know where the word university came from? Two words, or three words. Unity in diversity. See, before we had the universities that we have, the different schools were independent of each other. A medical school was just a medical school. You know, a philosophical school was just a philosophical school. The sciences were just a science school. Okay, the math was just a math school. We had all these different schools of higher learning that were running independent of each other. And somebody one day got the brainwave that there is strength in unity. So we're very diverse from each other, and we'll discover that if we work together, there is unity in our diversity. And so that's where they got the name university. And so our universities now are, there's unity in diversity. And that's the concept that we're talking about here. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will stand. A three-cord strand is not easily broken. You're stronger together. You're stronger together. My wife and I are very, very different from each other in so many ways. As a matter of fact, our premarital counselor said he didn't think we should get married. He did. I thought, what does he know? We got married anyway and love it. We're very, very, very different from each other in so many ways. I could bore you to tears with how we're different, but I got to give you an example. I'm pretty structured, and so is she in some ways. Many ways. So Wednesday was her day to do laundry. Okay? Kids are at school. She worked 3 days a week. Wednesday was her day off. Stay out of the house. Mom's doing laundry. There's piles of different colors all over the room. And she's got her system all figured out as to how this is all going to take place one after the other. And Wednesday was my day to write my sermon. She didn't want to be interrupted with what she was doing. I did not want to be interrupted with what I was doing because my sermon prep day was one of the most important days of my week. So the phone rang, and my secretary knew, don't put calls through to him unless it's an emergency, or my wife, which is probably an emergency. So she said, your wife is on the phone. I go, okay, thank you. And I picked up the phone. I said, hello. And she unloaded. I just said, hello. I said, well, what's the matter? Well, the washing machine, it broke halfway through doing my laundry today, and I had just put new water in it, and I was just going to put clothes in it, and I just put a bunch of soap in there, and now the soap is going to be wasted in the water, and my day is all off, and I'm not going to get the laundry done like I want to get it done, and it's all going to be a mess, and I don't know when I'm going to get this all figured out. That's the short version. Okay? And me, in my infinite pastoral wisdom, just with so much understanding and compassion, I didn't say it with the right tone of voice either. I said, well, why don't we just call the repairman in the Yellow Pages and have him come fix it? That's not what she wanted to hear. She wanted to hear me go on about how I understood how difficult this was for her. We laugh about it now. I missed it totally. Having it fixed was the last thing on her mind. Being understood was the most important thing on her mind. For me, there was only one thing to be on the mind. Spend $100, get it fixed. What's the big deal? I didn't get it. Okay? We're different from each other. And we weren't laughing about it then. That was a moment of intense fellowship. But you know what? We've learned something from that. We've learned something from that. I do the laundry. No, I'm just kidding. We've learned from it. So, a great marriage is not when the perfect couple comes together. It's when an imperfect couple learns to enjoy their differences, learns to enjoy them. Establish a date night. Do that to a nice, quiet coffee shop where you can accomplish a couple things. You can talk about the things you have in common, areas of similarities, areas of differences. And then after you have identified those differences in each other, then you put together, you talk about those differences as well as agree on a plan of attack, not to attack, but a plan of attack for these differences with love and with care, determination, commitment, and with love. Instead of finding a compatible mate, Christians are instructed to marry another Christian and become a compatible mate. Two shall become one. I hope that those words ring in your mind for the rest of your life. Two shall become one. It's a process of becoming compatible. And this is a transformation. It's a transformation. It requires the grace and the power of Jesus Christ. Because you know what? We've put a little axiom together that can be used positive or negative. Unless God changes you, you will not change, you'll only become more so. Unless God changes you, as you get older, you only become more so of what you already are. You know, no man wakes up at 65 on the day that he retires and decides to become a grumpy old man. He planted those seeds when he was younger. He planted those seeds when he was younger. And he wouldn't let God change him. I've got a name in my mind. His family won't even go see him anymore. It's terrible. It's awful. He became the grouchiest old guy on the planet. Unless God changes you, you only become more so. But if you do allow God to change you, you become a wonderful person. But it takes a transformation that only God can do. You can try to change yourself all you want. You can change yourself on the outside with your behavior, but you got to change. Only God can change the inside. Only God can change your heart. And we ask God all the time to help us to have the right attitude, the right heart, the right mind. Because we've sown the seeds years ago of what we are today. And when you get older, it's not easy to change at all. It's really difficult. So let God create that transformation. Ask God to do it. And that's good news to those seeking marriage or those already married, because as God does not leave us to change entirely to us, He doesn't. You see, His is the discernment, His is the power, His is the wisdom, and yours is the hunger and the thirst for His guidance and His strength for acts of obedience. You do not have the power to make those changes yourself. You can change your behavior for a little while. For a little while. But you know, that old nature is still inside there. And until God changes it, it's not going to, that old nature will come out. I got a story for you that comes out of, I like to study antiquity in different lands. And there's a story that comes out of, I heard it's around the 1500s in England, where a king was to pass on his kingdom to one of his two sons. And he wasn't sure which son to give it to. So he thought, I need to create some kind of a test to see which one of my two sons is the wisest and the most creative and the most gifted and the smartest. I got to do that. So he said to them, I want you to do something that will show me your creativity, show me how smart you are, how wise you are, and then I'll judge between you as to which two of you gets the kingdom. So away the two boys went, and they contrived their own creation. And the one son heard, found out what the other son was doing, and he knew instantly that he was going to beat him. He stopped what he was doing, and he did nothing. He created nothing, but he knew he'd win. His brother had taken a cat, and he had trained this cat to be a waiter. This cat would get up on its back feet, would have this nice little towel over his arm, and he had the white gloves on, his little paws, and he would come with this little tray, and this cat would walk up to you, and he would serve you a nice drink. And the king was going, oh, look at this. He trained this cat. Everybody was in absolute awe that he had trained this cat. Look at this thing. He's like a perfect waiter, a maitre d' in some fancy restaurant. Wow, he's going to win for sure. And the other brother, he just stood there. And when this son was finished with this magnificent presentation, his brother reached in his pocket, and he let out a mouse. You know what the cat did, don't you? You see, you can change yourself on the outside as much as you want. You can change your behavior, and you can look a certain way. But that may not be what you are on the inside. And when push comes to shove and life gets tough, the real you is going to come out. And Christ came to change us, to transform us. Transformation means, you know what conformity means? I love these two words, conform and transform. Conformity is what the cat was taught, to conform. I call it being conned into a form, conform. And that's what the world tries to do. It tries to con you into its form. But transform, the biblical definition of transformation, means being changed from the inside out. And when we talk about growing old gracefully together, walking hand in hand when you're 80 years old down by Stanley Park in love with each other, that doesn't just happen. You're young. Allow God to make those transformations, and which means you're going to sow the seeds today of being that wonderful 80-year-old couple that's walking down Stanley Park hand in hand like there's nobody else in the world but the two of you. What a picture that is. But it takes God's transformation to do that. It takes it. His is the power and the wisdom. Yours is the hunger. Marriage is more than finding the right person. It is being the right person. I'm going to talk more about that a little bit later. You know, we talk about being unequally yoked, right? Well, let's turn that around. What does it mean to be equally yoked? What does that mean? Well, being equally yoked is actually an agricultural term. I grew up on the farm. I know what this term means. You see, a yoke, have you ever seen the great big yoke that oxen use? Right? It's this great big piece of lumber that is thrust over the shoulders of these two oxen side by side. And then there's U-shaped other wood that is put underneath their neck, so they can't pull her head out, and each of them are tied to the top of this yoke. So, I mean, they are yoked together, okay? They are. It has to do with how oxen are placed side by side to produce straight furrows. The oxen needs to learn how to cooperate with each other. If they do not cooperate, if they do cooperate, there's a smoothness, there's a fluidity, there's a camaraderie, there's a pleasurable companionship, there's effortlessness, there's productivity. If they do not cooperate, they have perpetual conflict, stress, anger, no productivity, no companionship, and the farmer's mad. See, what they used to do is they would take a young ox and put it in the yoke with an older ox. And the young ox said, I don't want nothing to do with this. I'm fighting this thing. I want out of here. And there was conflict because the old wise ox, he just keeps marching along because he knows what he's got to do. And if we work together, this is going to work really well. And so while the other one is frustrated and fighting and it's getting awful, the old ox, he just keeps marching right along. Being equally yoked means that we're going to strive to work together. We're going to strive to work together. And here's the enigma. Opposites attract. Then when we get married, we try to change the other person to be like ourselves. And in so doing, we destroy the very real things that attracted to us to that person in the very first place. That's a big one. Because it's so subtle. It's so subtle. Maybe you've already done it, tried to do it. I tried to do it. So did my wife. We're very different from each other. And there were things in her that attracted me to her as a person that were wow. But I found out that when we got married and started living together, those things started to cut across the grain of the way I like to do things. So I tried to change her. I tried to stop her from doing that and being that person. And I found out that I was trying to destroy the very things that attracted me to her. Think about that. Because that's our natural instinct. And what counts in making a happy marriage is not so much how compatible you are, but how you deal with incompatibility. That's what Leo Tolstoy, the philosopher, said. So we're going to talk about love. Okay? We're going to talk about love. Today, I read this last week. Falling in love is like walking down the street and not seeing that open manhole cover and just falling right into it. We just fell into love like we fall into a manhole cover. Here's my favorite definition of love. This is facetious. It's not real. Love today, love is a feeling you feel you're about to feel when you get a feeling that you feel you've never felt before. Isn't that wonderful? Love is a feeling that you feel you're about to feel when you get a feeling that you feel you've never felt before. Isn't that nice? How's that work for you? It doesn't. It doesn't. So let me give you a biblical definition of love. Now, in the English language, we only have one word for love. I call it love. We only have one word for love. But in the biblical Greek language, there's four different words for love. Four of them. And I'm going to go over them with you. The first one is eros. It's physical love. It's physical love. Erotic. Eros. Physical. Sexual. Sexual love. We are the only creature that God created where sex is not just for reproduction. Sex is for bonding. It is for intimacy. It is for expressing your love. It is for sharing love. That's what it's for. This love was designated and purposed by God to create the deepest bond between a man and a woman, physically, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. We're the only creature that uses sex for two purposes, reproduction and true relational intimacy. The rest of the animal kingdom is just for reproduction. That's it. And consummating the marriage, which is sexual intercourse, is part of God's plan. It consummates the marriage. It's the beginning of that bond. It's where he bonds a husband and wife into one flesh. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. Somebody must have been in my notes last night because they said this, and I was just so happy to hear that the premarital team picked this up. The second word for love is philia. Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. Philea. Philadelphia. Brotherly love. Friendship. It's a love. It's a friendship. A husband and wife must be each other's best friend. I have dealt with, I can only think of one right now, marriage that was suffering because one of the people involved in that marriage had someone other than their spouse as their best friend that they would confide in. How would that make you feel? If your spouse was confiding in someone else, not you. That drives a wedge in your relationship. But it's not only to prevent that wedge from coming into your relationship, but to bring that happiness and pleasure into your life. You must be each other's best friend. You must. You have to be each other's best friend. And when you are, it is wonderful. It is smooth. It is wonderful. Another love is agape love, which is spiritual love. It's God's love. It's unconditional love. Now, a lot of people today are living together and they're not married. And to be bluntly honest, a lot of people who are living together and have lived together for 20, 30, 40 years and raised their kids and they've had a wonderful relationship. Some of them have had happier relationships than a lot of Christian couples have had. How do you answer that? Well, there's a number of factors there that I don't have time to get into. So you look at the two and you say, so what's the difference? There is a significant difference, and it's right here. Because only in the context of a godly marriage do you have the concept of spiritual unconditional love. Spiritual God's love in your marriage. The other marriage, boy, they dodged a lot of bullets and they've had some good times. And obviously they haven't had the kind of times that would really rock them to the very foundations in most cases. But we have God's love. We have unconditional love. We have that. Agape love is unconditional love. Here a husband and wife receive God's unconditional love and then they give it to each other. Also, through praying together, out loud, and being devoted to God in their home, their marriage becomes whole, healthy, and strong. Matthew 6:14. If you forgive others their trespasses, your Heavenly Father will forgive you too. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ has forgiven you. Unconditional love. Unconditional love. And then there's one more. It's called sorge love. Sorge love, which is protective love. Protective love. You know the difference between jealousy and envy? Envy is when I want what you've got. Jealousy is when I do not want to share what I have with you. That's why God can say I'm a jealous God. Because he doesn't want to share us with anybody. He wants us entirely to himself. He's a jealous God. And when you think about your spouse, you should be jealous of that person. Using the word the right way. I'm very jealous of my wife. I'm not willing to share her with any other man in any other way, shape, or form. I am not willing. She's mine. I will protect her at all costs. Kind of a funny story. When we were married, years after, my dad gave us a little gift to go to Hawaii, only time we've ever been there. And there's our condominium. There's this 36-hole practice golf green. Great place. And then there's two swimming pools, and then there's the ocean, right? Just boom, boom, you're right there. And Linda was a sun worshiper. I mean, she could spend all her day in the sun. Well, I don't want to lay by the pool all day. Well, here's this golf practice green, right? So I would go and I'd be putting on this practice green. And amazingly, we were there kind of close to summer. And so we were the only people out there by the pool. She had the pool to herself and I had the putting green to myself. And I'm putting away and she's by the pool. And all of a sudden, she was not happy with me about this. I enjoyed it, but she wasn't happy. She's there and all of a sudden, this guy comes up and he starts hitting on her. Okay? He's trying to put on the moves. And I'm over on the golf green, and I'm finding it kind of entertaining. Because I know that there's never a question about her morals. her morals. Never. And I notice that she's looking over at me, giving me the look that says, get over here right now and get this guy out of here. And all of a sudden I realize, you know what? I don't like this. This is my wife. This is my wife. And I'm going to protect her at all costs. You see, the church is the bride of Christ. He protects her. This is my wife, and she needs to know that I will do whatever I have to do to protect her. That's called sorge love. That's sorge love. A little while ago, there was a lot of activity across the street at our neighbor's house. And I saw cars were decorated for a wedding. Southeast Asian couple. And, it looks like a wedding. And there's people coming and going, and it's just crazy busy. And he's outside, so I go up to him, and I said, hey, what's going on? And he said, well, my daughter's getting married. Oh, congratulations. When's the wedding? Today. Oh, great. But then I thought, I have not seen a guy coming and going. And so I said to him, I said, well, like, I haven't seen, you know, her fiancé coming and going. Oh, no. He flew in from India last night. She's meeting him today for the first time. An arranged marriage. And so I said to him, well, like, what about love? He looked at me like I just asked the stupidest question he'd ever heard. But he was right. He said this. Love is to be learned. Love is to be learned. There is a kind of love that will get you to the altar. But it takes a completely different kind of love to stay married. He was right. We know an awful lot about love and how to get to the altar. But we don't know that much about the love that it takes after the altar to have a deep, rich relationship. I found this by William Shakespeare, and I'm not much of a poet, so I'm going to stumble through this. I've practiced this a bunch of times, and I still can't get through it without stumbling, okay? So bear with me. It's a great little sonnet. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not which alters when it alterations finds, or bends when the remover to remove. Oh, no. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is a star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but it bears out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I've never writ, nor no man ever loved. You see the endurance of the love there? No matter what? No matter what? Helen, I'm supposed to be finished at 11:45. We've got 10 minutes. So we're going to start with communication. I kind of wanted to start without as a fresh start, but let's get started because we've got about 10 minutes. And then if you have questions, you can hand them in to Pastor Josh, or you can just stand up and ask them, okay? So let's start talking about communication. I kind of wanted to start this fresh after the break, but we'll start it now. Communication. This is the biggest issue in your relationship. The degree to which you successfully communicate is directly proportional to how successful your marriage will be. If you don't learn to communicate, it's not going to go well at all. And learning to communicate is going to be the hardest thing you do. It is so hard. Communication, on one hand, is so terribly simple, but it also is the most complex thing you do. It's such a conundrum. I read recently about a man in northern Alberta, in Vegreville. He did not accept the $125 fine for illegal parking, nor did he accept the $300 fee for having his car towed away, when there was a sign that specifically placed where he parked his car that said, fine for parking. That's what its sign says, fine for parking. You know, it's all in how you look at it, right? How can something so simple mean something so terribly different? We do it all the time. My nephew came to visit from Michigan, Ohio. And it's a very, very different culture there. It's where my wife is from. It's a very different culture. And he's a pretty serious kind of guy. And so I decided to have some fun with him for my own pleasure. So, and we know each other well. We love each other. We have a great relationship. And he tries to pay it back now. So I said to him, we're driving up to our street. And I said, now, I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you this. Because we have some families in our neighborhood that their children are just kind of slow, if you know what I mean. They're just not that bright. They're kind of really slow. And I can't understand. I said, I can't understand. Look, I said, look at that sign right there. It says slow children playing. They're advertising that they have slow children. And he looked at the sign, he looked at me, and we just started to laugh together. You know, you can take a couple, three words, and you can twist them to mean something. You can interpret them completely, totally different. So now he's driving around all over Columbus, Ohio, trying to find signs that can be interpreted different ways. And he texts me and he says, I found this sign that said this, and this, and this, and this. On one hand, communication is one of the simplest things you do. On the other hand, it's the most frustrating thing you'll do sometimes. Okay? Here's what communication is. Communication is a process. It's a process that is verbal and it is nonverbal, of sharing thoughts with another person in such a way that he or she understands what you are saying. That's a huge statement. It's a process. It's both verbal and nonverbal, of sharing thoughts, impressions, feelings with another person in such a way that they understand what you are saying. Communication is 7% words. 7% what you say. It is 38% tone of voice. Well, I told you that I love you. Oh, that'll work. I said I love you. So when you're listening to someone, it's not just the words. You're listening for their tone of voice, their attitude, right? And it's 55% body language. Isn't it true that when you're having what I call a moment of intense fellowship, that you don't want to be looking at the other person? You'll even turn away from them? Or you get right in their face? Body language. 55% of communication is body language. That's what the experts tell us. We hear only 20% of what is being said because instead of focusing on listening, our minds are formulating our rebuttal. So how are we supposed to communicate? The normal approach to marital communication is this. The desire to hear. I'm sorry, the desire to be heard. The desire to be heard more than to hear. I want to be heard. I don't want to hear what you're saying. I want to be heard. The needed approach to marital communication is a desire to hear more than to be heard. Proverbs 10:19, he who restrains his lips is prudent. There's three crucial areas in communication. There's understanding, which is the heart of communication, understanding. What's the number one problem in communication? Take a guess. Pardon? Misunderstandings. That's a good one. That's not the word I'm looking for. You're right. Assumptions. Well, I assumed you meant this. No. And the number one need in communication is listening. Listening. That's the big one. Are you listening? Now, I've got a couple minutes. Do we have any questions? Because I got about 3 minutes before. You want me to keep going, Bill? Or are you going like this, which means eat? Sig Fan? Ay-ya, come on. Oh, I got to tell you this. I don't trust any of you anymore to teach me Chinese. I don't trust you because you set me up to make a fool of myself. So years ago, when Fraserlands and Knight Street were one church, two campuses, I was really new there. And, you know, to kind of really get in with the people, I decided I'd try to learn some of the language. So it was New Year's Day was on a Sunday. And for the benediction, I decided I was going to do it in Cantonese, okay? Like, I am going to impress the socks off of these people. And how do you say Happy New Year in Cantonese? San Lin Fai Lo, right? That's not what I said. I got up and I said, San Ging Guai Lo. Crazy, insane white guy. And they laughed and they laughed and they laughed. And I thought, no, what did I just say? That was not funny. So, Bill, I thought this was Cantonese for let's eat, but you're saying keep it going. Okay. See, we're not communicating, Bill. We're not communicating, and it's all your fault. How's my body language right now? All right. How can something be so simple yet so difficult? There's five levels of communication. First one is cliche conversation. How's it going? How's your day? Sunny day out there. Nice clean car. Cliche. How'd you like the game last night? Level 4. Reporting the facts about others. Do you know that Joe went into the hospital yesterday, had his appendix out? Just reporting the facts. You know, the meeting's supposed to start at this time. Just reporting the facts. That's all we're doing. You know, I told you I put the money in the bank. It's there. It's in the bank. Okay. I'm going to the store. Okay. You know, we're supposed to go out tonight. Yeah, okay. Just reporting the facts. Then there's a third level where I begin to share my ideas and my judgments. What do you think about this idea? What do you think about that idea? I think this would be a good idea. I think that would be a good idea. No, I don't like that idea. We start to share our ideas and judgments. You can see how we're becoming a little more intimate in our communication. We've gone from have a good day to, you know, how do you feel about doing this today or doing that? And then comes level 2, where you start sharing your feelings and your emotions. How do you feel about that? Now we're getting personal. Now we're getting personal. So I want to ask you the question before I go through all five levels. At what level do you communicate the most in your marriage? What level? Number 1, complete, emotional, and truthful personal communication. Complete, emotional, and truthful personal communication. That's where you really get lovingly honest. Those are the levels. And the question for you is, at what level do you operate in your marriage? If you have not pursued compatibility and love, you're probably working somewhere between number 3, maybe number 2. But when you let God transform you and change you, number 1 is where you want to be. So let me show you how confusing communication can get. There are 6 different possible messages that come through. Okay, I was teaching a young adult Sunday school class for years, and we knew each other really well. And one day I said to them, I was probably in my 30s, I said, you know, no one believes that I'm 58. What did I say? They went, we didn't know you're 58. Did I say I was 58? I said, no one believes I'm 58. But I was deceptive, wasn't I? Intentionally. And I was making a point. I was making a point on another matter. And I wanted to point out to them how confusing communication can be, how terribly confusing it can be. Because the one of the first levels is what you mean to say. That's the first level. What you mean to say. Well, that's not what I meant to say. Well, then why didn't you say what you mean? Right? That's the first level is when you mean what you say. And then the next one is different. It's what you actually said, which may be different than what you meant. It's what you actually say. See how we've already got confusion? What you meant to say and what you actually said. And then the third one is what you heard the person say, which is different than what they actually said, which is different than what they meant. See how frustrating this is getting? And then there's what the other person thinks he hears, what he heard, and then how he interprets it, what he thinks. And then there's what the other person says about what you said. We haven't even got down to what you mean yet. So there was what you meant to say, what you actually said, what I heard you say, what I think you meant, and then what. Now I'm going to say what I have to say in return about what you said, which is different than what you meant. And then, number five, what you think the other person said about what you said. And then number six, now we go back to number one, and around and around and around we go. And eventually you'll come to the point where you say, well, that's not what I meant. Right? You've been there. You know it. Well, why did you say that in the first place? Well, I didn't know really how to say it. But wait a minute. Communication is so simple, isn't it? But look at how complex it can get. How very, very difficult it can get. So I think, okay, it's 10 to 12. We're going to break right here. Questions, either on paper to Pastor Josh, or you can stand up. He's got a mic, and you can ask your question out loud. Questions?
Please ask some questions. Lunch is a little late.
Here we go.
Hi, I'm Vincent. So actually, I was more a statement question regarding the first part where you mentioned the four things that we learned from the Genesis, right? That, and I think from a Chinese culture, maybe even the Eastern Far East culture point of view, is that first part of severing from your parents, I think that had been, people who have grown up here and the Western culture, this is maybe more easy to accept, whereas people who come from the traditional Chinese culture, even you mentioned the South Asian culture, the Indian cultures, is very, very difficult. And if we don't put it in the right way, your parents, your grandparents, your family can take it the wrong way, and they would find that just being Christian, they would interpret as, oh, that means you abandon us because of the way that deep-seated culture, how we relate to our parents even after we married. So I just thought that's a comment that we want to address, and even as people, a new couple, who may want to take that with some thoughts.
Yeah. Why don't you just say what you mean? I'm kidding. I recognize that. And I only know a little bit about that because of the years that I spent here. And I understand what a monumental issue that is. I understand that. Biblically, and much of the biblical context was in an Asian setting. And even then, when Mary and Joseph got married, there was the year of betrothal before the actual ceremony. And this is in that kind of that Asian culture setting too, which is somewhat different than ours, but some similarities. In that year of betrothal, she would go and prepare for having her own home. And he would be busy either building or finding the new home that would be theirs, separate from their parents, Mary and Joseph being a good example. But I understand a little bit about how critical that dynamic is. I live in Abbotsford, where there's a lot of Southeast Asians, a lot. And I notice a change that's happening. And Linda and I'll go for a drive, and we'll see this. Whereas they used to build one house and just live in it together, I now notice that I call it a lodge. They'll build one big house, but it'll be like a row house, 5-star plus. But you will see one main entrance to the house, which is kind of a big common area. And then on this side, you'll see like 4 other entrances, like a row house. And on this side are 4 other separate entrances for 4 separate domiciles. So we're beginning to see a shift in the Southeast Asian culture, which was always together under one roof. So now they're starting to give them more separate domiciles, and it's making relationships a lot smoother. So I understand what you're saying, and that's a tough one. That's a really tough one. Very good point. Thank you. Anybody else? Tombert has an answer.
I'll talk to Pastor Jim about it. You mentioned about in a relationship that you need to be transformed from the inside out. Yeah. So what do you do, and I'm not saying this on behalf of myself, is if your spouse doesn't see it that way?
Next question. What I'm going to say is easily said, but it's awfully hard to do it. And I'm going to use the wife as an example. 1 Peter, God says that an unbelieving husband can be won by her reverent and chaste behavior. We do not change by what we're told. We're changed by how we're influenced in conduct. And the only way that person is going to change, allow God to change them, is when they see how you behave as you should. You see, your focus, I'm going to pick on Tombert, your focus is to be a godly husband. Your focus isn't that she has to be a godly wife. That's God's department. And when you focus, I'm picking on Tombert, when you focus on being the man that God wants you to be and you love her the way you should, you know, it can take a long time. It can take an awfully long time. But she's not going to change until she sees that in you. And so when you have a spouse that does not want it, God's call on you becomes even more clear and strong, that you focus on being the loving partner that God wants you to be. And God, the Holy Spirit, will make that person see it. It may take an awfully long time for them to come around. Some of them don't. But without that in your character, it's got to happen. It's a good question. It's a good question. Because you know what? There have been times when I have been resistant. I've been resistant to the change that God wants in my life. I have. Okay, let me give you an example. I apologized to her so much the other day. I felt so stupid. I felt, what an idiot I am. And it's just before I'm coming here and I'm going to talk to you about marriage. How's that, right? So she wants to get her Christmas decorations out. I said, it's not December 24 yet, girl. She likes it up early. So there are 2 wreaths that are always under the bed. And I was busy studying all this stuff. focusing on trying to make a good presentation. And she says, can you go get those wreaths from under the bed? And I was ticked. Don't you know that I'm serving the Lord here? I've got this great... I didn't say that out loud, but I'm thinking, you know, I got to go and, you know, talk to these people about marriage. So I'm ticked off. And she doesn't know I am. So I go and look under the bed, and they're not there. And I remembered that last year she said, would you please take this one thing to the Goodwill value, give it to the secondhand store, you know, some mission, because I don't want it anymore, this Christmas thing, this old wreath. Yeah, sure. And so my excuse was I thought she asked me to take all three of them, but she hadn't, just one. But I hadn't taken all three. I looked under the bed, and they weren't there. So I came out and said, I don't know, I guess you must have given them away. They're not there. So I went off and did some errands in the afternoon. I came back, and there they were on top of the dining room table. I said, where were they? She goes, under the bed. I was so busy being an idiot. Believe it or not, I was so blind, I couldn't even see two big wreaths under the bed. Like, how bad is that? But here's what really convicted me, Tombert. Linda has to be hooked up to intravenous at least 5 days a week or she won't be alive. So I have been trained and I hook her up to intravenous every day. Okay, it's just for hydration or she'll die. And if you see her, and you might see her this afternoon, she can't walk very well. So she's hooked up to the intravenous pole and this line. And she goes into the bedroom. I said, how did you get those wreaths out from underneath the bed? You're hooked up to the IV. And she explained to me how she had situated the IV pole. It's on a pole with wheels on it. It's on a rod. I called her boyfriend. His name is Rod. And she lined it up beside the bed. And she held on to the bed, and she managed to get down on the floor with a broom and pull these things out and just put them quietly on the dining room table. Convicted me. Her behavior convicted me. I said, okay, God, time for some more work in me. Okay? Does that answer the question? Did I illustrate it? Yeah. Yeah. That's life, folks. That's life. And I had a hard time getting to sleep that night because I felt like such an idiot. How can I be so dumb? Why would I be such an idiot? And she just, you know what? She never said a word. She just went on and did it. That's what it is, Tombert. That's what it is, all of us. That's what it is. And you know, I told her I was sorry. She forgave me. We're better off. We're better off. Do you think I'll ever miss those things under the bed again? Not a chance. I'll know it. I just don't like seeing them because it reminds me. Okay, any other questions? That was a good one, Tombert. Yes.
I'm Eliza, and Vincent is my husband. And there was one statement saying about the four types of love, and one of them was filial love. Mm-hmm. And you said that husband and wife should be each other's best friend.
Yes.
I know my husband doesn't have many friends, so I know I'm his best friend.
Right.
But for women, I find, for me personally, I don't know if I can be his best friend, because to me, best friend is saying, like, everything in details, right? Like, wow, you know. But I know my husband can only take so many details. So to me, best friend is knowing all our thoughts or everything about us. So I think my husband, like Vincent, wouldn't mind if I said he's not my best friend. Because to me, best friend means, like, I don't think I hide secrets from him. But it's, you know, I don't know if the women know what I'm talking about. We could go on hours and hours without.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
but
yeah,
I do that to him, I think it would be a big torture. He'll rather die earlier. So I don't know. Does it matter? Like, I don't know if I'm the only one that thinks that, my husband may not be my best friend in that sense.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. Can I comment on that? Because that's a very, very good point. When I say best friends, I mean best friends, but I also mean no secrets. But my wife lives in solitary confinement because of her condition. Linda is the most social, she's a social butterfly. Greater punishment for her than her illness and her condition is living in solitary confinement. She's isolated from social contact. And it is extremely important from her standpoint and from mine that she have some lady friends. Because there's certain lady things I just can't do. I don't even want to try. I don't want, and she needs lady friends. I get that. I get that. But there can be no, I can't be closer to anybody than I can be to my wife. Be the closest person in my life. That's the bond of marriage. But that's okay. You still need those special friends. Any other questions, or Bill, is it time? Does this mean eat?
Now?
One more question, anybody? Bill, I'll give you a minute because I'll answer a question that was sent to me. A couple of questions were sent to me. Oh, yeah. There's one question I'll speak to. When you get married, after you're married, you're not the same person. No, you're not. You can't be. We change. Life changes. Life experiences change us. I read one book in preparation for this where the guy made the statement. He says, by the time you're 80 years old, you'll be married to the same person. It'll be 12 different people. You'll be 12. You know, that person will be 12 different people by the time you're 80. That person will be 12 different people. And it's true because life changes us. Kids come along. Health issues come along. Parent issues come along. They all change us. And we got to learn how to go with the flow of those changes. You're not the same person you were 10 years ago. You're not. Life changes you. And we have to learn how to adapt to that as well. So I think we're done for now.